Welcome to Politics and Right. My name is Egberto Willis. With us today is Dr. Andrew Bard Schmuckler, PhD, a prize-winning author, former Democratic candidate for Congress in Virginia's very red Shenandoah Valley, former talk show radio host, summa cum laude, graduate of Harvard University, PhD awarded with distinction in a program specifically created to accommodate his original theory explaining how civilization was developed, and a frequent columnist in newspapers around the world. Welcome again, Dr. Schmuckler. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. I'm eager for this conversation.
I am as well. Let's start with what we intend to do here. Dr. Schmuckler has a series called A Better Human Story. And what we've decided to explore with Politics Done Right, because as you know, we like to enlighten, we like to learn, and we like to exchange ideas. We hope to prick at the brains of Dr. Schmuckler and entertain that which he offers. Now, I want to start though, Doctor, with the beginning of your A Better Human Story on your website. You wrote a book. The title of the book was The Parable of the Tribes. Tell us that story that you told in the beginning of A Better Human Story, because I found it enlightening, but I want it in your words.
You know, I'm working on a series now called The Fateful Step. So The Better Human Story is from 2017. I keep on trying to create a framework to lead people into what I feel like I've seen. So I don't know what the story is as I told it, but let me tell a story as I experience it now hearing your question. My world fell apart in 1967, 68. And it wasn't just mine. I mean, there's all kinds of things going on. I could make a little list of how the world blew up, but my world blew up, and I felt I had to come up with an answer for why is the world so full of destruction and torment? You know, we're talking about assassinations, about Soviet tanks in Prague, the Chicago Convention, the war in Vietnam. I had been an ambitious guy on a conventional path, but I had to come up with an answer to that question before I knew how I fit into the world. Is this got anything to do with what I tell there?
Yes, please continue.
Okay. Yeah. Then two or three years later, I had an answer came to me. I actually felt that something had been shown to me.
Let me break you right there, because remember also within your answer, you had a conversation with your brother. So let's continue.
Well, I don't know which conversation you'd be. I've had a lot of conversations with my brother. He's a very wise man.
Well, I mean, where you wanted to, you were expressing some of what you're saying now, where you're saying, well, you know what, this has come to me. And it was the precursor to you writing the parable of tribes.
Yeah. In just the course of a few minutes in 1970, I saw something about what had happened to our species, something that was, that put the whole picture into a different light. And I spent years developing this. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, off the top of my head. I don't know how all that happened. But I spent years, and I wrote a 1,600-page dissertation. And then I got a grant from Ford to condense that into a normal book. And 14 years later, it came out into the world. And what I say that I prove in that I felt it was so important to develop this that I sacrificed a lot to get it done. And I thought it was important because what I prove, I just like presenting it in these two statements, right, these days, because I've been working on this for over half a century and the other things that I've built around it. One thing I prove is the ugliness we see in human history is not human nature writ large. I claim I have proved it. And the second thing I like to say to indicate why it would be important if it was true that it was proved is that any creature on any planet, anywhere in the cosmos, that takes the step that humankind took 10 or 12,000 years ago, the step onto the path of civilization, the fateful step. And the path of civilization means a creature, for the first time in the history of life on Earth, the human creature extricated itself from the niche in which it had evolved biologically.
Explain.
By inventing its own way of life. And I show that that step, which is unprecedented in the history of life, creates a situation that is also unprecedented.
Let me cut you right there. I want to break you right there because I don't want to, and this is yours, so I really can't break your train of thought here.
That's okay. You put me through whatever paces you want.
I want to qualify that a bit. We have heard of cattle. We have heard of zebras. We have different animals that seem to live some sort of a communal life. We have ants that create mounds and have a hierarchy. We have beehives where we get a queen and it has some sort of an organization within that group. How does that differ from, let's say, we create in a society of the sort that we have?
Yeah, okay. That question gets to a very important point indeed. When I say it extricated itself from the niche in which it evolved biologically, that's the key thing. There is a natural order in which these other societies exist. Evolution, which produced us, mm-hmm. and which we are part of what life is able to create over 3.5 billion years.
Right.
It's continually creating an order, not just the order of our cell or of our organism, but the way I like to put it is the lion and the zebra and the grass are working together to create a perpetual motion machine, even as they devour each other. But when a creature invents its own way of life, a way of life which it wasn't handed down in the genes. I mean, we were cultural animals for a long time. We had language and we had fire, and we had tools, but we were still living pretty much continuous with what the primate
hunting-gathering
ancestors.
Hunter-gatherers, yeah.
Yeah, so they may have had languages and music and stuff like that, but they were still bands living off of what nature spontaneously provided. It's different when not through the genes, but through the creative intelligence of a creature that's more creatively intelligent than anything else that life had created in 3.5 billion years. And that creature starts to figure out, well, these vegetable foods that we've been gathering for hundreds or millennia, we can start to grow as crops. And these animals that we've been hunting in the hunting part of our hunting-gathering life, we can gather them into herds that we control inside pens or out in the hills or however the herders did their thing. This is something new. It's not only a new life form, it's a new kind of life form because it emerges out of the creativity of the creature. And there are no rules in place to govern how it might evolve. And I'll stop there because that we're on the threshold of how the anarchy that inevitably unleashes creates a social evolutionary process that's destructive and that people couldn't control.
Well, you have an interesting way that you put it in your second paper here, and that is that at first it seems like you call anarchy as being the first part, and then that civilization itself actually creates anarchy. I think that's sort of a nebulous concept.
We get there in two easy steps. So biological evolution has created all these systems where the parts have been selected over eons or whatever to work together to maintain the viability of the system over time for the long haul. So that's the natural order. That's what evolution works to create by choosing what survives to perpetuate its kind over what doesn't. Gregory Bateson once said, no creature can win against its environment for long. So the rough edges get smooth. It's invasive species that are destructive, you know, like that. So there was, in the system of life up to that point, a natural order in which the interaction...
Could you put your camera, click your camera up a little bit more because you keep getting your head to the top. Okay. There you go. Great. Thank you. That's good.
Well, I got to get it to stay there.
Yeah, you got to get it to stay. That's one thing. All right, good. Let's continue.
I'm sorry about that.
That's all right.
So we've got these civilizing societies emerging. How will they interact? They're not governed by the natural order, which all, you know, the lion and the zebra and the grass, you know, not like that. And there is no human imposed order because this is a very fragmented system. Wherever life emerged, I mean, civilization emerged independently, like in the Nile and the Tigris, Euphrates, four other places around the planet, it always emerged in clusters. And these things were going to have to interact with each other in some way. But what's going to order their interaction? The point is, there's no natural order. There's no human order because it's too fragmented for anybody to be able to say, here are the rules that we're going to enforce. It's really just anarchy. And we've seen what happens with anarchy in my lifetime anyway.
Explain anarchy to folks who don't understand it.
Well, there is no order that prevents an actor from doing whatever he can and wants to. So in the 70s and 80s in Lebanon, the state broke down and there was anarchy and warlords rose to control the situation. And then in the 90s, we saw it again in Somalia, where the state broke down and there was anarchy. And over a certain period of time, the warlords came to dominate Somalia. That's what happens when there's anarchy. Thomas Hobbes, a great English philosopher of anarchy, said that anarchy inevitably entails a war of all against all. And who do you think is going to prevail in a war of all against all? It's the gangsters. That's how they get to be mob bosses.
The stronger one, the fit shall survive, right? The fittest, the survival of the fittest. The survival of the fittest, right?
Yes, but no longer in a situation in which the competition has been molded to provide for the perpetuation of the living system. There's not a wholeness to the survival of the fittest when we're talking about a war of all against all. That is not regulated by any kind of order. And so if what prevails, you know, human cultures, we're starting to invent our own way of life thousands of years ago. You know, we had different kinds of chiefdoms and we had different kinds of kingdoms and all the way up until we end up with tyrants enslaving the many and conducting wars to build their empires, which is what we generally see when civilization fully emerges. At each stage along the way, there is this interaction, this war of all against all. And only certain, it's not random which ones are going to prevail. You know, there can be something really beautiful, but if it doesn't allow you to survive in a world where it's not controlled how power is going to be used, if all want to live in peace, then all may live in peace. But what happens if all but one wants to live in peace and that one is bent upon predation and expansion? The options for the other tribes are limited. They might be destroyed. In which case, we've seen even in the Bible, whole cities put to the sword and stuff like that. So if they're destroyed, and then the imperial power takes over that territory, so the ways of power have spread, or maybe they conquer some weaker people and enslave them, absorb them into their power system. Again, the ways of power are spread. Or it could be that the threatened society sees what's happening to its neighbors and it says, we better get out of here. And they go to places where we have still found, they're like the most remote places.
Right.
Tribes in the Amazon, or, you know, the New Guinea jungles, or the Eskimos in the north, places where something fairly much like hunter-gatherer peoples.
Let me stop you a second, because I still get a bit, it's this part interests me a bit here with regards to societies and independent societies and how we are so different. As we migrated to different parts of the world, I imagine we all began in Africa somewhere, and then there were different migratory paths that took people to different parts of the world. Did society, all these different societies, did they have some commonality? And if they did, does that say that there's something within our genes that breeds that?
Well, we can, from fossil, I mean, if you're talking about like prehistory.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're talking about when, as hunter-gatherer people spread.
Well, yeah, I mean, we all started one place, right? You agree
with that? Yeah, By the time we start the path of civilization, we've got people in Oceania, we got people in Australia, we got people in the New World.
Were they civilized at any point before the great spread, the split, or whatever?
Well, I think the evidence is that the process of emerging out of hunter-gatherer into civilization was something that was starting to happen, because it happened independently in a half dozen places.
And, right.
But the spread spread of hunter-gatherer peoples, there were tribes and of various kinds, and you see different kinds of tool making. They probably had different languages. They probably had different rituals, but there weren't cities. That comes later, and then there's the spread of certain ways of organizing a society. The power of a society in a war of all against all is a function of just about every dimension of a society. How you organize the economy, whether you've got good central control that can deploy its forces in a coordinated way, whether they've got the technology, whether they're mounted or unmounted. Oops.
You're getting too excited, Doctor. That's what happens.
Yeah, well, you know, this idea actually, you know, it is kind of exciting if it's true that the ugliness we see in human history is a result of the anarchy, which is inevitably the consequence of a creature creating civilization. It's not a reflection of human nature that we end up with the spirit of the gangster playing a disproportionate role in shaping how civilization develops.
And that's the reason that I like to have you on, because that is my belief and that's a tenet that I live by. And that allows me to do what I do, not believing that intrinsic to humanity is evil.
Yeah, you know, we were shaped to be motivated to do what serves life. Not that that's always a simple thing, but we were shaped to find fulfillment in those things which our ancestors had found was conducive to their survival. You know, there's a reason why when we're hungry, we eat. And there's a reason why we get highly motivated to do what produces children. There's a reason why we feel fulfilled living in a society which is got goodwill toward men and peace on earth. All of these things are life-serving, and we are built to find fulfillment in what has been life-serving and for our ancestors as we got shaped into being who we are.
That is profound. Where does that take us? In other words, the vision that you've seen, where does that take us?
Well, there's more. I would like for listeners who find it interesting, who would want to know, if I deliver the goods when I say I prove those two statements, you know, if that doesn't interest them, oh, well, you know, then you know, there's no point in looking further. But if you would want to know, I hope that we can tell them where to find these ideas laid out as systematic.
The platform is yours, sir.
Well, but what I want to say is that if we are better creatures than we have seen ourselves to be, because we've looked at the world around us and we've looked at the history of humanity, and there's so much ugliness. And right now in America, oh gosh, there's so much ugliness right now. It is hard not to feel kind of repelled by much of what we see. And yet, if we understand how our species got dealt a kind of impossible situation, not because of anything wrong with us, but because we had the creative intelligence to take a step whose implications weren't clear at the time. They didn't know they were unleashing something that had never occurred in the history of life on this planet, but that's what they were doing. But only because they were, and so we can be more compassionate with ourselves. Understanding we were dealt a very difficult hand. We are going to be living in a human civilization which is being shaped by the spirit of the gangster. Imagine and the war of all against all. Imagine, you know, if somebody like Putin or Hitler, I mean, think of all the monsters, and even in our own world of the last century that we've seen. How is it? I mean, there aren't that many people who are as monstrous as those. Trump, I mean, he's the worst thing I've ever seen in terms of I've never seen any human being who so flagrantly manifests so many fundamental defects. I mean, but you know, democracy was supposed to prevent that. So that's a whole other story. I mean, there's a whole other dimension to my thought, which has got to do with how did America come to the point where an American president can be the first guy to refuse to admit that he got beat in a free and fair election, and he foments a coup d'etat, committing crimes right in front of our faces, and be supported by 3/4 of the electorate of one of America's major powers. That is a huge phenomenon that just cries out for some kind of explanation, and I have been working on that explanation.
Well, you know, also, I hope within the explanation you point out that we're really not, we were never really a democracy, and our creation didn't want us to be one, and our creation also wanted to maintain a certain group in power. So, I mean, if I believe what you had to say, I believe that we have in fact evolved, and we also kind of evolved to less evil, if you will. So maybe we go into spurts, but I think Trump, I don't know that Trump is much, first of all, I agree with everything that you've said about Trump, but I don't know if Trump is all that much different from many of our other leaders. Just
I agree about entirely. Saying it. But he epitomizes. He epitomizes it. I said about Trump when he was just seeking the nomination that he was the same wolf but without the sheep's clothing.
Exactly.
In terms of democracy, you know, I was a social. You know, I got radicalized in the late '60s, and you know, so I know the critique. You know, I focused a lot of energy on the critique. Nonetheless. In the America I grew up in, the America of Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, all the way up, well, then about 30 years ago, I saw something was changing. Mm-hmm. And it is quite fundamental what changed. And it told me a lot more about what forces are at work that make the world more broken. So that's for another occasion than this one. Here, I want to talk about the fact that we see a lot of disgusting things, but what I have proved should help us be more compassionate with ourselves and realize that we have the greater capacity to make a more whole world than we would give ourselves credit for. We live in a culture in which ideas like original sin and the depravity of man have played an important role. And, you know, the weight that we carry because of what we think of ourselves, you know, there are a lot of studies, I think, that show that if you get a teacher to expect well of their students, they do well.
Yes.
Expectations are important. And I believe I've proved something which should make us feel better about ourselves, have more compassion for ourselves, and feel ourselves to be more capable of healing this broken world. It doesn't have to be this way forever if we're plugged into the wholeness that we've got within.
Why don't we start to explore that?
Throw me a pitch for batting practice, and I'll try to pull it into the left field.
Okay, your claim is that we are better people than we think we are. I agree with that, by the way. That's why you're here. But how do you express that as being a formula that you found? I mean, I will say that it's a formula. I'm saying that I think I've lived it. You're saying that you proved it. Two different things. I've lived it. You approved it.
Yeah, I haven't just proved it to either. But here, see, what I'm saying is that step by step, I show that any creature on any planet that steps onto the path of civilization has inescapable implications. It generates a destructive force inevitably. It doesn't matter what the nature of the creature is. I expect that in other places in this vast cosmos, they say there are 6 billion planets in the Milky Way alone. I'm imagining there are a lot of places where some creature or other has started creating some civilization. And I say that wherever that happens, whatever the nature of that, and I think that I prove that there's no escaping the logic that there will be a selective process out of the war of all against all, which is inevitable, that mandates that the ways of power, the spirit of the gangster, will predominate in shaping how the civilization evolves. It's not a direction that is a function of the nature of the creature. It's a function of the anarchy that empowers the spirit of the gangster, regardless of the creature.
Put that in English. What do you mean by the spirit of the gangster?
Okay. You've seen the Godfather movies?
Yeah.
So I make you know? I could call it the spirit of the warlord. Like what I said about the kind of people who come out on top when there's a war of all against all, and some are going to be victors and some are going to be victims. Mm-hmm. It's not random which ones will prevail.
So when you said not random, what do you mean by it's not random?
Okay. I was saying a little while ago, but I don't think I completed the thought, that the power of a society, and we're talking about the power to prevail in the war of all against all, the power of a society is a function of all kinds of dimensions of the society. So if a society gets more powerful by a certain political structure, or a certain way of raising its children to be fierce warriors, or developing iron to replace bronze, or developing ways of waging warfare that are strategically more effective, whatever it is, whatever they have done, whatever helps a society prevail in that war will survive to spread its ways in the human world. Other ways that might be better, might be beautiful, but if you can't go up against your neighbor who's a tyrant or, you know, a conqueror or whatever, a gangster, if you can't survive that, you're going to be either wiped out or subordinated or have to retreat, or you're going to have to match the power of the society that threatens you. And that also spreads the ways of power. So what I say is that power functions as a contaminant. It's contagious. It spreads throughout the system inevitably. It is a function of anarchy that the spirit of the gangster, which is that which prevails in the war of all against all, the petty hoods all compete with each other to see who's going to become the medium-sized hood. And then there are turf wars and such. And eventually you end up with, Vladimir Putin controls everything.
Well, interestingly, I think I won't disagree with you, because I think you've done, you probably have, with your thought process, points out something that I think a lot of us have figured out, that one of the biggest gangsters on the planet right now is that big C word called capitalism, because it's the one system designed where it can have a whole lot of folk work and sell their excess labor at a discount, their excess intellect at a discount, for folks who are absolutely doing nothing to collect on that, to enrich themselves on the intellect and work of others. If that's not gangster, I don't know what is.
Well, there is gangster capitalism. And then there's capitalism in other forms. I've written two books about...
Well, wait, let before you go there, because I want to explore that. I don't want to give you a pass on that, because I'm using your terminology here, and I think you've really given me that segue to prove what you're saying. And that is, when I look at our economic system and who benefits from it and how the benefit is accrued, meaning, again, when those people who own shares, et cetera, own shares and sit on their butts and other people do the work, I think that is exactly what you could call a gangster type of activity, right?
Let me amend that some.
Sure.
I want to make a distinction between the corporate world as we have it now, with the Koch brothers, mm-hmm. and the whole fossil fuel industry buying pieces of the government and buying whole political parties.
Don't go too far, because you actually laid out a map for me that was I get it.
But I think that you and I also do differ in a certain way, because I distinguish between that and what we'll call the market system. Mm-hmm. There is an ideal understanding of the essence of capitalism is the ideology that's put forward by that founding work of Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. And my dad was an economist, and I have a lot of respect for the market properly used. Mm. I've written two books about what's wrong with the market, even properly used. Mm-hmm. I critique the market because it has blind spots in it. It warps the way a society develops. But it's a different it's a different critique than the critique you've got, which sounds very Marxian, about surplus labor and the exploitation. I don't see it that way. What concerns me is that it's necessary to correct for the blind spots of the market. And also the wealth that's created in the market cannot be allowed to buy political power. Those are the dangers that are involved in the market economy.
This conversation is going to last a long time, because I see you as a scholar who have actually answered the question for real, but who, like many other people in your position, discount their own answers because of a ideological bent. In other words, what I'm trying to say is, you have the answers. You said it. And not only have you said it, I think when you tell me that you proved it, I think you really have. But there's usually a pushback I find with Americans, even American economists, et cetera, that after they've gone through all that indoctrination about their system, and yours as a scholar comes out and see the answer, you then say, yeah, but exception.
Yeah, Alberto, no, it's not It's not that. It's looking at the ideal of the system, mm-hmm. which needs to be maintained, which is, you know, fair competition, nobody has market power, stuff like that. There's a distinction between that and what happens when, because even that creates problems. But nonetheless, if you look at the world, you look around the world, and you say, what are the most decent societies? I would say the most decent societies in the history of the world all make use of the market. I mean, it's true in Sweden, it's true in Denmark, it's true in Switzerland. I mean, a lot of, you know, you look around to find something better.
And that is the argument I hear a lot.
I think what it shows is that a society in which the governmental power is not been so corrupted by the plutocracy, the money power, mm-hmm. that it's unable to function on behalf of the whole system. But what we have in America, and we didn't always have it quite so bad like when I was growing up, but we've got a political system in which the force of greed is enormously powerful. The force of the people has been subordinated to a much greater extent than was true, coming out of the New Deal and all the way.
This series is going to be long, and you know why it's going to be long? Because I think we are going to have a very good conversation on the market that I think is going to take more than that going to take several hours of conversation. Because
I'm happy to be. Let me just say the two books that I've written mm-hmm. on it. One is published by SUNY Press, mm-hmm. which is called "The Illusion of Choice: mm-hmm. How the Market Economy Shapes Our Destiny," mm-hmm. and I make the case for how it's necessary to control the market more than more than we Americans are generally able to do because of the power of the plutocracy, the corporate system. And the second book, published by Harper, whatever they were at that time, Harper yeah. San Francisco, I think it was, is called Fool's Gold, The Fate of Values in a World of Goods. And it talks about how the way the market attends to that which can be bought and sold warps the society's concept of the good.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, interestingly, and again, people have to, I think folks have to look at things from different avenues. You know, I mean, I noticed that when you talk about all the economies that all the countries that have worked successfully, which I've spoken about, Bernie Sanders has spoken about the countries like Sweden and Norway and all these guys, right? We have a new view of them with their democratic socialist type of being that sort of regulates the market strong. The market, I actually call it a mythical market, but that's for another day. How they regulate the market in a certain fashion. Mm-hmm. But what there are certain things that I think, and I think this would be left for another discussion when the market comes up again, that we don't take into account, right? All these countries that you've spoken about, right, have actually pilfered other countries to build up their riches, right?
Yeah,
I need to finish this sentiment.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, and the reason I want is because so that the next analysis that we do, I'd like that to be in the thought process of you explaining certain things to our audience.
Okay. But, so can I respond to that?
Yes, sir.
I had this thesis that was gonna rule my life mm-hmm. about how power has corrupted the evolution of civilization. So mm-hmm. I had every motivation to find in the Marxian idea about the importance of the imperialistic dimension to Western capitalism. Mm-hmm. I looked at it. I looked for it. I wanted to be able to develop.
And that's what I'd like to. Would actually help us.
And I came to the conclusion that it was not a majorly true thing. I mean, it's certainly true that the Western powers abused their power over a lot of peoples. The Belgians in the Congo, it's a nightmare what they did. It's disgusting what they did. And, even the better colonists like the British, did a lot of terrible things to people just because they had the power to do so. So the imperialistic thing is, but I see it more as a function of the selection for the ways of power. And not in the Marxian approach as being, the wealth of the wealthy nations is a function of their, it's wealth they've stolen from the poorer peoples that they colonize. I know that argument. I couldn't find a good case for it.
That is funny, Doctor. But let me qualify that. No, you can put it in your stand if you want. That's fine. We have time.
I've lost one of the legs.
Oh my God! You got.
Oh no! I got it again. I got.
We're gonna have fun. We're gonna have fun because I think this is a necessary conversation, and let me tell you why, Doctor. All right, you're a scholar, done a lot of reading. I'm just an engineer. Okay. And we look at things differently, right? I look at things with ones and zeros and just math. That's it. Nothing else. That's all I believe in. You have all these other things that you can go by. And I enjoy that. But there are certain things that are mathematical, and there are certain things that are ideological, cultural, ideological and cultural. And what I find in America a lot of times is that we have a very hard time, especially as we grow older. You ever heard the story that says, as we grow older, we become more conservative? In my case, as we grow older, I became a hell of a lot more liberal and activist, but I am usually sort of an exception to a case. But as many grow older, they become more conservative. I don't understand why, really, but again, I love what I read from you, and I wanted to use it as a good platform for us to have this conversation, and with an open mind on all sides, I hope, but I know, mine's always open.
I really respect and appreciate the openness that you show, because in this conversation about the economy, I've taken a pot shot at a couple of things that are not trivial in your thinking about things, and you have responded with such a an interest in seeking the truth.
And that's the idea, right, Doctor? I mean, think about this. Look, I am not wedded, and that's what I try to explain to folks, right? We all have an ideology, we all do, but we should not be wedded to an ideology proven wrong.
That's such a, I so much appreciate integrity like that. My dad had integrity, and I had an experience at Yale when I found out that my dad wasn't typical of all academics. but the thing I have had good fortune and bad fortune in my life. Mm-hmm. I've had the bad fortune that I've had a mission to get certain ideas out into the world. And even though I got like a full page review in the New York Times and a prize and stuff like that, I really did not succeed anything like what I tried to, which is why I'm doing podcasts now.
Well, actually, I think you sell, if you think, let me tell you something. Okay. Here's an interesting thing. Will be live on air as well. So you're not only a podcast when you're with Politics Done Right at all. You're also on Pacifica Network and several others. So you're going to get pretty good. People are going to hear your voice as I try to get everybody's voices heard.
Well, I hope I managed to show something with all these words I've spoken.
Well, actually, sir, you have. And you've tickled my, and I am pretty sure we have, America is a smart country when they're not taken for granted. So, I mean, I honestly believe that.
I wanted to say one way I have been very fortunate. I fear that it'll sound like boasting, but it really is gratitude. I could not have asked for more, for the world to have helped me more, become somebody who could speak about these kinds of things.
Yeah.
The parents who were teachers, to the schools I went to, I just wouldn't know how I could have had a better opportunity. And I've just been passionate about taking it as far as I could.
And I think that is great, sir, because like I say similar things as well. I'm fortunate that I have a platform. I'm fortunate that I went from an engineer to a radio show host. I'm fortunate that I am able to understand these concepts, even having not gone to Harvard University and studied economics and all these other things. I did it all reading, right? But here's the interesting thing that I want to go on, and this is going to go into our next program. I'd like our next program to cover, be a continuation of this, because this is a very, very interesting conversation. I think, like I mentioned, the last statement I made was that we all have ideologies, but we should not be wedded to them.
Right.
And the reason we shouldn't be wedded to them is, you may enlighten me to something, and I hope that if some of the way things that I think about may enlighten you. I mean, you never know. But when it comes to what I find is that you have come out with some solutions to talk about the goodness of people. But most importantly, in this conversation, you've talked about the person who usually wins is the gangster, right? And you're right. Unfortunately, you're right, because we the people have still learned to follow gangster. I wrote a blog post the other day and said, one of the interesting things that we do is we have a way of following psychopaths. Okay? I equate the gangster to the psychopath. In other words, the person who
doesn't. Definitely a component.
Right. So I agree with what you had to say there wholeheartedly. Now, what I'd like to consider for our next program, it's amazing when you're having fun how fast time goes, right? Because that we're having. But I'd like us to examine a continuation of where we're going, where you brought up the fact that gangsters is, that we ultimately get ruled by gangsters and they're the ones who win. Because I think that point that you've stated there is proven with America, it's proven with Trump, it's proven throughout not only the Western world, but we can go country after country. And then I would like to use what you've said about most people being good and that we were the only species able to evolve as we did. How do we mitigate that?
Well, to lay out a little bit more of the table, let me say a couple of things.
Yes.
One is, I think that I prove that any civilization creating creature like mm-hmm. ourselves mm-hmm. has as its central challenge to order its civilization well enough, soon enough, that it doesn't destroy itself first.
Okay. That is where we start on the second. I love that segue, sir.
And if I can put one more thing on the, I call this my integrative vision, you know, the pieces I've tried to put together. And, mm-hmm. and there's one that I call a secular understanding of the battle between good and evil. And I think that I can show in a good social scientific way, like having studied the flow of forces in history, I can show that a central part of the human drama are two coherent forces battling each other to see which will shape the human future, the human world. One is being a coherent force that consistently spreads a pattern of wholeness, and another a coherent force that consistently spreads a pattern of brokenness, and that we in America are now getting a very good view of the battle between good and evil.
Dr. Andrew Schmuckler, thank you so kindly for the first episode of what will be a continuing a continuing discussion on a better human story. Thank you so kindly.
Thank you so much, too.
We spend a lot of time deconstructing the news, trying to parse it into a form that everybody can understand. We try to find those little nitpicks where it flies above the fray, etc. If you really like these videos that we do, I want to ask a big favor. Please go ahead, number one, subscribe to our channel, and number two, please join if you can. Thank you so kindly for watching. Keep watching. Please remember to share. We must populate the entire internet with our progressive message, a message that we know is what most Americans say that they want. So help us, please join.